So watching the various memorial services and other type of services that are going on now in Vietnam and Europe, America, Thai's monastic practice centers. I don't know if some of you have seen that. We will be sending out the links later, so you could all watch it. It's all been highly recorded, and so even if you missed it, you can watch it. But watching it and seeing the what did we see? The great, the thousands, hundreds, and you know, of monastics and the just the veneration, the ritual surrounding him and what he's created. I thought I'd share with you something else about him. Because behind the great patriarch, the great man, the great bodhisattva, great teacher, there was a man, a human being. And I was fortunate to have encountered him since I first encountered him back in the 70s. So I want to share that with you because not many people have had that opportunity. So I feel very fortunate. And so I've written about it in some places, so I don't need to go into the stories of it, of things, but so when I first connected with Thich Nhat Hanh, Thai as he was called, in the early 70s, I felt an instantaneous connection with him. Even though I was in America and I just was reading about just a few of the things. But primarily I was very moved because here was a Zen monk very involved in peace work and reconciliation work. And that was very inspiring to me. He kind of brought together the sort of spiritual and the social transformative. I think the speaker's gone out. Can you please go up? Are we okay now? Can you hear? So so he brought together those two aspects. So I was very moved by that and touched by that. Because that seemed so unique, you know, at the time, to bring those two together. He was sort of like, you know, like a Martin Luther King or like a Gandhi, you know, people who both had a very solid religious, spiritual dimension, but also entered the world in a very dramatic way. And so I was very excited to, you know, to discover somebody who was in the Buddhist tradition, which was my tradition at that time. But when I met him in Paris, he was everything I was looking for and more. Because I realized I was in the presence of a Zen master. A Zen master who had none of the adornments of a master. He lived in an apartment, he didn't wear formal robes. He was very busy and active in his peace work and refugee work and all kinds of things that he was involved in. And yet, I knew I was in the presence of somebody who didn't talk the talk, but who walked the walk and didn't talk about it. So what was he like? He was like you'd expect, present, just present. And it wasn't as if the presence that he gave was a formal presence. He was present to everything. When you were talking to him, he was totally present to you. When he was, I remember because he was involved with a lot of correspondence with people in Vietnam and all kinds of things. And the way he would he would read the letters, you know, so many letters. And all of them, you know, sad letters in those days, difficult letters, bad news letters. And he would just, you know, look at them, read them, stop, put them down, you know, just very present. He drank tea in that way. He washed dishes in that way. He prepared food in that way. His ability to be present to everything equally. There was no, you know, this is more important than that. This, you know, it wasn't like that at all with him. And I'm sharing this because it was a teaching I'm trying to pass on to you. I mean, his practice of presence was continuous. I never saw Thay Nhat Hanh in a hurry. I never saw him rush. And yet, as you could imagine, he accomplished great things, more than any of us could imagine, right? And yet he did it all, you know, as a Zen master, you know, one thing at a time. And when he was doing that one thing, that was his full attention. And he was also very balanced. I mean, very active, lots to do, but he knew when to just put things down. You know, let's have a cup of tea. Let's just talk together. Let's go for a walk. You know, and everything was done in the same spirit, very balanced. So I think that's the first thing that really struck me was, you know, there's lots of talk about living in the present moment and, you know, paying, you know, fully involved. I mean, I've been hearing those teachings for years, but I'd finally met somebody who lived them, right? Very powerful teaching. Of course, it came out of his, you know, his kind of Buddhism, which was this engaged Buddhism, you know, a Buddhism that did not distinguish between, you know, religious life, spiritual life, and worldly life. He felt Buddhism had to be totally engaged in all aspects of life, all aspects of the individual, all aspects of the family, all aspects of the society, you know. And again, he lived it because if you look at the volume of his writings and teachings, you'll see he just covered all areas, you know. Wherever he turned his wisdom to, his intelligence to, he lit that up. And yet, he lit it up because he was a Zen, he was an enlightened Zen master. His mind was awake. All the potentiality of his mind was always available to him. He had a great intelligence. I mean, it was all humble, you know. He had no airs at all. He had a great simplicity. I mean, another thing that struck me at that time was I had never met a Zen teacher who talked about love. I had met many Zen teachers who talked about wisdom, awakening, you know, living in the present moment, you know, all that stuff, good stuff. But he talked about love. I mean, he had that soft side of him. He was very, he was love. I mean, when you were with him, you knew he loved you. I mean, that sounds funny, I mean, because it wasn't, it was just, you knew he cared. You know, he knew it was just, and he cared for everyone he encountered. You know, like sort of being with him over those, you know, mostly in the 80s and the 90s, just seeing how he related to everyone, you know, young and old, especially he loved young children. Young children loved him. My daughter's here. She knew him as a young child. She'll be sharing later. He loved young children loved him, because he had that childlike quality to him. He had a great innocence. He was very sophisticated, but he was very naive in a childlike way, and he always kept that alive. He loved to play. Yeah. You know, he loved people to sing. I'm trying to remember, did I ever see him sing? Because we sang a lot, and he always liked people to sing. In those days, Sister Chong Kung, who is then a laywoman, Cao Feng, had a beautiful voice. And every night she would sing. And a lot of her songs were actually poems of Thay Nhat Hanh's that had been, you know, turned into songs in Vietnam. I mean, he's an extraordinary teacher, because he talked about love. He talked about loving relationships. He was a Zen monk, a celibate Zen monk, and yet he taught us. You know? One of his most beautiful books is Teachings on Love. You know, he was very concerned about people and their relationships, their relationship with themselves, their relationship with their families, their partners, their parents, their children. You know, that was so important to him. It was like, if we cannot show up in all our relationships in a loving, caring, kind way, then again, what is our Buddhism? You see, what is our Zen? If it doesn't manifest in the world. And again, when he meant the world, he didn't mean like out there the world, he meant in the world that we live in. And he lived it. What else? Relationship. Again, a Zen monk, right? Someone who was renounced relationships. he renounced, you know, having a partner. He renounced, you know, having a family, because, and yet he replaced that with considering everybody his family. And he just, so many people were his friends, you know, so many people considered themselves his friends. And when he created his Sangha, and we are a Sangha, he liked to think of a Sangha as a family, right? Not as a people who just practice the same path, follow the same teacher, but as a like a family, people who know one another, love one another, take care of one another, are there for one another, enjoy one another, you know, and that emphasis on community as family and the importance, you know, because I think he was very struck when he, not only did he, when, I mean, sort of in Vietnam, where the war and the civil war was creating such, you know, was kind of rendering the society apart in many ways, and families apart in many ways, and a lot of the solidarity of Vietnamese society was being torn apart. So that was very obvious. But when he came to the West, you know, he lived in France. His exile began in the 60s. He was very struck by kind of, that's sort of the same thing that happened here. you know, that families, that people were not connected. They were not connected. They didn't feel connected to their societies, to their communities, to large extended families, to their villages. You know, that there was a kind of a rootlessness, he would think. You know, people didn't have those roots that they used to have. And I think it was especially poignant to him in his encounter with overseas Vietnamese, to see what, just in one generation, that they were beginning to have all the social problems, you know, that that the rest of us had. And so he was very moved by that. And so he very much felt that he wanted his spiritual communities to be real communities. That's what he chose. You know, we don't call ourselves a temple. Right? We don't call ourselves a Zen center. We call ourselves the Florida Community of Mindfulness. That comes from him. Right? He felt that was really one of the most important things that we can give beings in this world, a place where they can feel connected, where they can feel nurtured, where they can heal, where they can feel taken care of, where they can feel accepted, you know? Because he was, you know, he was very astute. And he was very unusual because, as opposed to most of the Asian Buddhist teachers who were coming to the West then, who were coming here to teach, to spread, he didn't come at that at all. He was kind of trapped here when the government wouldn't let him come back. So, but his eyes were very fresh, and so he was very perceptive, and he could see what was going on in society. That is why, you know, he made one of his key teachings, you know, living in the present moment, being present to your life, because he saw people weren't present. People weren't present to what was in front of them. People weren't present to their eating, to their walking, to their tasting. They weren't present to each other, you know. So he was very attuned to that and to correcting that. And so therefore, he molded his teachings. He had, you know, if anybody is familiar with the volume of his teachings, he was a profound Buddhist scholar, a profound Buddhist philosophy. I mean, he was familiar with all the depth of Buddhist teachings. And yet he was willing to primarily give these very simple teachings, right? That most of us connect with him over and over again. Why did he do that? Because he saw the suffering. He saw the disconnection, the rootlessness, and he wanted to give something, to bring benefit. Yeah, so much I could say. One of the things that strikes me is we are here only because of him. You know, just speaking personally, I mean, I sit here, this is the jacket he gave me with his hands when, after he ordained me in the Order of Interbeing in the 80s. This is the lamp he gave me at the Dharma transmission, when he transmitted his Dharma to me in the 90s. if that had not happened, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be here. I mean, I had no aspiration to be a Dharma teacher. I was quite happy to be a Dharma student. I love Buddhism, I love the practice, but I was just living my life as a layman and practicing, of course, and seeing him. But I had no interest in being a Dharma teacher or anything like that. But, after he ordained me, I sort of had no choice but to begin. And it's just interesting how these things happen, you know? the fact that I sit here with you in this, and all of you online, you know, it's all a miracle. It's all just the unfolding of causes and conditions. And sitting, it was funny, when I was sitting here the night that we heard, what night was that? Seems like a long time ago, that Friday night. Friday night when we sat and we had like an hour of sitting, and sitting there looking at him, and I realized this is all because of him. And I'm just one of his children. He has thousands of children, tens of thousands of children, right, all around the world. You know, this is, you know, no coming, no going, right? There is no coming, there is no going. There is no birth, there is no death. He taught this over and over again, right? And yet, there is birth and death, right? And the great being has left this world system. And yet, he's left so much, you know? He's left so much. I mean, how one simple man, and he was a simple man. He was not the builder of great organizations. He was not the great evangelist for Buddhism or mindfulness or engaged Buddhism. He was a poet. He was a writer. He was a man who loved to walk in nature. He loved to tend his vegetable garden. You know, my thought is he would have been very happy spending his life that way. But he was somebody who was a great bodhisattva, which means he had, deep in his heart, he had made the vow to spend his life not only cultivating his own awakening, but also to end the suffering of others. And that's what he did, right? His whole life. And that's what he's transmitted. Selflessly. You know, I was going to say a few words just about sort of how I've tried to bring the spirit of his teachings into our community. You know, just to be honest, if you go around and you see a lot of Thich Nhat Hanh communities in the Plum Village tradition, we're a little different here. And I think that's because when I encountered him in those early years, before there was a Plum Village tradition or a Thich Nhat Hanh tradition, where there was just him teaching me and showing me the way, you know, the other things he transmitted to me was, you know, the spirit of experimentation. Very, you know, and he was an experimenter. I mean, he experimented with Buddhism. As you can see, so many creative teachings that were just flowing out of him and practices. And he always says, you know, Buddhism is experimental. Buddhism always has to be renewed. Every historical age needs, Buddhism has to be reformed and revitalized. So it's always relevant to the people. He also said, said American Buddhism has to be American. He said, you know, Vietnamese Buddhism is the culture of Vietnam. Tibetan Buddhism is the culture of Tibet. Chinese Buddhism is the culture of China. He says, you know, very important that you create an American Buddhism, you know, where everything is in English, where everything is, and that it relates to the culture, you know, the music, the art, the everything, you know. The other thing he, you know, was non-denominational. He even though he was obviously a Zen monk and he had his lineage and tradition, his message was, you know, Buddhism is a rich field of wisdom and understanding expressed in many different ways. And so, you know, his approach was, you know, learn Buddhism. Take from the wisdom of our ancestors, all ancestors, not just only of you know, a certain Zen lineage. And you know, he himself, even though he was a Zen master, he often would teach basic sutras like the Anapanasati, the Satipatthana sutras, which are from the Pali or Theravada tradition. So he himself, you know, was very open. So in our community, you know, we do a lot of what he taught me. We try to be experimental. We try to be non-denominational and take from all the Buddhist traditions. We try to create community where people feel a sense of belonging and nurturing. We put a lot of emphasis on relationships and healthy relationships. And we put a lot of emphasis on, you know, how to help people learn to live in loving ways to each other, and how to deal with misunderstandings and conflicts and angers and the kind of darker side of life, that there is a way to be present to all that, right? And to work with it in a healthy way that can be resolved. You know, his teaching was what? You know, he sort of paraphrased A.J. Musty. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. You know, his teaching was, you know, the absolute is available right now. Right? Freedom is available right now. Liberation is available right now. What does that mean? For people who feel anything but liberated and free right now. It means just taking that shift wherever you are, whatever you're doing, letting go of everything and just touching the presence of this moment. Freedom is available washing the dishes, when all you're doing is you're just washing the dishes. And he loved to wash dishes. He loved the soap and the water. Yeah, I mean, you know. I mean, I can't think of anything he didn't love. Well, that's not true. He didn't love meetings, that's for sure. But. Meetings. He didn't love that, blah, that blah, blah, blah that we seem to do so much of. Because I think he was a man who loved words. Yeah, so, you know, Tai, and I see we're just a few more moments, you know. Traditionally in Zen, other traditions, masters pass on their tradition to their heir. You know, it's Dharma heirs. As far as I know, it was never Tai's intention to anoint a Dharma heir for himself. As he would often teach, he would say, in this age, one Buddha is not enough. This world needs many Buddhas. You know, and he took that teaching from the Lotus Sutra. In the Lotus Sutra, there's a chapter, wonderful chapter toward the end, which says in the Dharma ending age, and we're certainly in a, you know, this is not one of the high points of human history, the age we're living through. But it said in the Dharma ending age, bodhisattvas multitude, thousands would come out of the earth. Right? to heal the planet, right? To help sentient beings, you know? It's like in the past, you know, one Buddha could show up and you know, bring the Dharma to the world. But he said, in the Dharma ending age, it's not enough. So he felt that all his communities, all his students, we were his continuation. And he often said that. He said, I will never die because of you. I am continuing in you. Right? And that's true. Whether we have just read his teachings, whether we have listened to his talks, whether we've had the opportunity to experience him, whatever we got from him, whatever we have gotten from him, it is in us, which means he's in us. He lives in us. And it is up to us, each of us, to see ourselves very consciously as his continuation. You know, there's a calligraphy that he wrote that I think is outside our Dharma hall, which is, you know, see with the Sangha eyes, right? Listen with the Sangha ears, you know, walk with the Sangha feet. But we could also say, you know, see with Thay's eyes, listen with Thay's ears, walk like Thay. I mean, that's very helpful, you see, to a practitioner to kind of feel their teacher is within them. You see, it helps us kind of come out of ourself, come out of our usual way of hearing and seeing and smelling and tasting and walking, you know, just to think, I'm washing the dishes like Thay washes the dishes. I'm listening like Thay listens. You see, it's very helpful. And in that way, there's no separation between us and Thay. So again, to me, our community, our teachings, in all ways, we are doing our best to be a continuation of him. I am doing my best to share what he shared with me, not only through his teaching, but through his presence with all of you. And, you know, in a few weeks, there will be a transmission of the five mindfulness trainings and the three refuges. And, you know, when I transmit them in his name, because he's the one who authorized me to transmit it. So when I transmit it to people in our community, realize that, you know, this is the formal way, traditionally in Buddhism, that we connect with the teachers and we connect with the lineage. Because when we take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, we take refuge in the teachers of the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And Thay is our teacher. So that is another way in our community that we transmit him and we become his continuation. I mean, hopefully it's not just a ceremony that people go through, but they feel they've been empowered. Again, I'm sure if you have seen, type on Google, death of Thich Nhat Hanh, and you see, you know, CNN, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, you know, all around the world, you know, he was quite something, the effect of one simple man. And it's quite wonderful to know that he's touched so many, affected so many, of all the high and the mighty and the low and the humble, all are his. But I'm just speaking here to our little piece of Thay in our Florida community of mindfulness, that we will feel that heart connection. And what I want to share with you this morning to give you a little personal sense of him. Because again, you can see all the memorial services and everything that are online, and it's quite big and formal. And we can read We can read the books, but not realize behind the books there was an author. And that author was a human being, just like us, who enjoyed a cup of tea, who enjoyed a mindful walk in nature, who loved people, and was loved by people. So we will now take a break. Those who can help David, we will reset up the hall and invite the people from the Lotus Room to come in and join us here, because they are members of our community, and we should all be together. And so in about 10, 12 minutes, we'll begin our memorial service, and when we come back together, I will share with you what we'll be doing. But it's simple and hopefully meaningful. Yeah. You know, it's that paradox of Buddhism of the relative and the absolute. You know, on one side, a great light has passed from the world. On the other side, the great light is lit right now. So that's how we live it. So we will again, I invite you to use the restrooms here in the Ed building if you need. Please go outside, do some walking meditation. The large bell will ring to invite us back in, and we will reset up the hall. Thank you, everyone.
If everybody would like to stand behind their cushion to begin.
Can you light some incense? So traditionally, before ceremony, especially such as this, we do three bows or prostrations. If you're comfortable doing that, I invite you to join me in doing three prostrations to show our deep honor, love, respect for Thich Nhat Hanh. But if you're not, you just want to bow, please do whatever is comfortable to you. The most important thing is our mind state.
And we have the chanting books that we'll be using for the service being passed out right now. Once we begin, we'll begin with the incense offering, which Jacqueline will begin for us, but then we'll all join in with the version that's on the inside of the cover of the chanting book.
Gratitude, we offer this incense throughout space and time to all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. May it be fragrant as earth herself, reflecting careful efforts, wholehearted awareness, and the fruit of understand slowly ripening. May we and all beings be companions of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. May we awaken from forgetfulness and realize our true home. Contemplation on no coming, no going. This body is not me. I am not limited by this body. I am life without boundaries. I have never been born, and I have never died. Look at the ocean and the sky filled with stars, manifestations from my wondrous true mind. Since before time, I have been free. Birth and death are only doors through which we pass, sacred thresholds on our journey. Birth and death are a game of hide and seek. So laugh with me. Hold my hand. Let us say goodbye. Say goodbye to meet again soon. We meet today. We will meet again tomorrow. We will meet at the source every moment. We meet each other in all forms of life.
So if everybody would open up their chanting book to the sutra opening verse. And I'll begin with three bells and then we'll chant that together. And now our choir will chant for us the five remembrances.
To grow old.
if everybody would please open their chanting books to the Heart Sutra, the heart of Prajnaparamita. And this we will be chanting together. I will begin with the beginning incantation, followed by a bell, and Sharon will be accompanying us on the Mukuyo drum. She'll begin with the first beat, and we'll all begin chanting together on the second.
Thank you.
The world is a flower. Gods are flowers. Enlightened ones are flowers. All phenomena are flowers. Red flowers, white flowers, green flowers, yellow flowers, black flowers, all the different kinds of colors of flowers, all the different kinds of love shining forth. Life unfolds from life and returns to life. Such an immense universe, oh, many lives. Flowers of gratitude, flowers of sorrow, flowers of suffering, flowers of joy, laughter's flowers, anger's flowers, heaven's flowers, hell's flowers, each connected to the others and each making the others grow. When our real mind's eye opens this world of flowers, all beings shine. Music echoes through the mountains and oceans. One's world becomes a world of millions. The individual becomes the human race. All lives become the individual. Billions of mirrors all reflecting each other. There is death and there is life. There is no death and no life. There is changing life. There is unchanging life. Flowers change color moment by moment. Such a vivid world, such a bright you. You were born out of these flowers. You have no beginning and no ending. You are bottomless and limitless, even as you are infinitesimal dust. You are the flower. You are love. All beings shine out of colors. You are one, you are many. Only one moment, only one unique place, only the unique you. Beside you, there is nothing. You dance, appearing in all. From nowhere you came to nowhere you go, you stay nowhere. You are nowhere attached. You occupy everything, you occupy nothing. You are the becoming of indescribable change. You are love. You are the flower. Sisters and brothers, brothers and sisters, it is time to bring to mind Thich Nhat Hanh and to send the energy of loving kindness and compassion to him. Let us sit and enjoy our breathing for a moment, allowing Thich Nhat Hanh to be present with us now. Brothers and sisters, please listen. The peace and joy of the entire world, including the worlds of the living and the dead, depend on our own peace and joy in this moment. With all our heart and with one pointed mind, let us begin anew for the benefit of ourselves and our loved ones.
Now, Jacqueline will share the merit on behalf of all of us.
Reciting the sutras, practicing the way of awareness, gives rise to benefits without limit. We vow to share the fruits with all beings. We vow to offer tribute to parents, teachers, friends, and numerous beings who give guidance and support along the path. May we be born now in the pure land within the heart of a lotus flower. In the moment when the lotus blooms, we touch the reality of no birth and no dying. May Buddhas and Bodhisattvas be our companions on the wonderful path of practice. May we end all afflictions so that understanding can arise, the obstacles of unwholesome acts be totally dissolved, and the fruit of awakening be fully realized.
So that ends the formal part of our memorial service. And now traditionally we, if it was a usual type, we would ask family members to say some things about their family member who has departed. But I've asked four members of our community, and again, I could have asked many, but sort of to represent us, just to talk briefly about how their encounter with Thay and his teachings affected them deeply. First is Jacqueline.
Dear friends, I feel very, very fortunate to have encountered Thich Nhat Hanh in 1999, when somewhat on a little bit of a whim, went to Plum Village without really knowing much about Buddhism whatsoever, and had the good fortune of being in a Dharma hall that was not much bigger than this, and had just about this many people, perhaps. So it was very, very intimate. And years after, I went to several other retreats where there were five or more hundred people, but it was still this wonderful presence of this remarkable man who gave us that sense of how to be fully present and fully in the moment. And what was most significant as I left that retreat was that we heard a teaching from Thay about his experience with a loved one who was dying and how he and Sister Chong Kong provided comfort to this man who was dying. And that was where I first heard the song, which we'll have in a moment, No Coming, No Going. And this sense of, I am not this body is not me. And so what was so wonderful for me was that my two most beloved aunts, one aunt and one uncle, passed away within 6 weeks after that. And so this sense of impermanence, as Thay transmitted it, was something that I felt so strongly that it was a really important teaching for me to really hold dear and to try to understand as best I can. And his sense of continuing, I also felt so moved by when I saw how he was returning to the temple in Hue, because I had an opportunity to visit there too and see him there. And I was so moved to think about how, with his continuing to live with the inability to any longer walk or talk, that yet he stayed here to inspire us and to really show us the way in his most amazing presence. And to have now witnessed on the Zoom or live stream that we've been able to see of the ceremonies there have been very moving to me, because I really feel that I now have this sense of what it means to be continuing and to be, you know, the fact that he and all of us can be there in the star and in the ocean and in the bamboo.
Next will be Angie.
When I encountered, well, really before I encountered Thay in 1999, I thought that to be happy, to have a meaningful life, I had to accomplish something. I had to achieve something. So there was always that living in the future, you know, it will come in the future when everything lines up in a certain way. And then I went to the University of California at Santa Barbara, kind of on a whim also, based on a gentle suggestion from my dear friend Diane Powell, and showed up at this retreat with 900 people on campus, and it was just full stop. I had never stopped like that in my adult life. And Thay taught, just with his presence, and really all the monastics, but that to just be was the most important thing, to be, as Fred said, with each moment. I found myself enjoying tying my shoes, doing the simplest things during that retreat, and learning from Thay that, you know, everything that we do in our life starts with who we are, and then our activities manifest from there. And it really changed my life. It changed how I made decisions at work with my family. It was no longer a question of weighing this possible outcome versus that one. It was like in my heart, you know, what would Thay do? What's the right way to make this decision, you know, from a place of peace, of love? Maybe 10 years later, we sat with him again in a very different environment in Hanoi. And again, this was an area where Thay was trying to come back into Vietnam. Monasteries were forming. There were so many people that were so joyfully coming out to see Thay, many Vietnamese. And there was a lot of distrust by the government. But Thay was just always who he was. And at that retreat, even though you could feel that you know, the government was watching us. You know, there was a bit of unease for a lot of us retreatants, but you never saw that in Thai. And at the Vesak Day celebration, where there were so many Buddhists from all over the world who had come to Hanoi, and there was a lot of that chat, 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 lots of meetings and things, lots of different denominations coming up onto the podium, making speeches, a lot of jostling going around just to try to get through hallways. And Thai was just singularly peaceful. He did not give a speech, I remember. He had one of the Dharma, lay Dharma teachers got up and said some words, but for Thai, basically his message to this group of, you know, several thousand people was, we sat on the stage and did Namo Valo together as a Sangha. And it was just beautiful. And then the final time that I had the honor to be in his presence was, you know, maybe another 8 years later, I think maybe 2017 in Plum Village. And at this point, Thai was, you know, in his wheelchair, not really able to speak, but we would still do walking meditation with him. His attendants would, you know, take his chair up and down the hills, would walk with him, and you could see he would gesture. You could see a half smile. You could, you know, there he was in the midst of what for many of us would be very difficult. And again, he taught me that lesson, taught all of us that lesson, that we just, you know, you be with presence and love wherever you are, and we could all feel that from him. So, you know, continues to be a lesson for me, and I just am so grateful for this experience with him that's changed and continues to change my life.
Thank you, Angie. And now, Brian.
So actually, I never had the good fortune of meeting Thich Nhat Hanh in person. But I think, like many of you, encountering his teachings they didn't change my life, they saved my life. You know, I was so lost, and when I read his book, Pieces Every Step, I felt like I was home, and it was so clear. And then just learning how to be happy, learning how to live life. I was a ghost. I was like a dead person. I was like a ghost. I was like a dead person. And he showed how simple life was. You know, reflecting on some of the key teachings, him challenging, or asking me to challenge my beliefs about what I thought I needed to be happy. And learning how just to be present is enough. And learning, you know, all the wonderful things, learning how to be with emotions, how to recognize emotions. I mean, we talk about this all the time in Sangha, but when I encountered them in the way he presented them, because I read other teachings before that, but the way he presented it, it was just so simple and clear. I just had to water the wholesome seeds, stop watering the unwholesome seeds, heal, and be present, and just applying it saved my life, really. And it's only through him that I found Fred and found the Sangha, because I heard that I thought he was a dead monk when I read his book. And I said, oh my gosh, he's alive. And Fred was teaching around the corner from my apartment in St. Pete at the time. So I think probably, like a lot of you, he was a life raft in this broken society and the broken life I had developed for myself. And I'll just end with saying, I would have loved to meet him, of course. But there's a teaching that always resonates with me that he gave, which he said, you know, if the Buddha were alive today and everybody found out, they'd all want to go see him. You know, if he was in India giving a talk, everybody would be buying tickets and everybody would go see him. But he said, but nobody would really see him, really see him. And if you really wanted to touch the Buddha, better to stay at home and do walking meditation. And so I really feel, although I didn't meet Thay, I just come back and be present to my walking, present to my wife, present to Sangha, and I'm encountering Thay in the real way.
Thank you, Brian. And now Karuna.
Thank you. I guess I have the opportunity to just share what it was like meeting Thay from a child's perspective. I haven't seen him since I was a teenager. And, you know, I'm Fred's daughter, Karuna. So I did grow up in a Buddhist household. I feel like I had the great fortune of seeing Thay as a child. And as my dad said earlier, I mean, he really loved children. And I was really fortunate to be on the receiving end of that. You know, my earliest memories are being in Plum Village. And he would go on walking meditation with the Sangha usually after Dharma talks, but I think at other times too. And you would typically hold a child's hand, would hold a child's hand. And, you know, I felt we all wanted to hold his hand. And I can remember trying to like strategically walk close, hoping that, you know, I would be the one who'd happen to be next to him when he like, you know, put his hands down and my hand would be there. And I speak for myself, but I felt like it was a common experience. You know, and we just wanted to be in his presence. He would, in the beginning of Dharma talks, he would sit the children in the front, and he would start his Dharma talk with a Dharma talk for the children, and then the children would leave after how long, but I would leave and have their own program while he spoke to the rest of the Sangha and the adults. And we would just sit there and all of our attention would be on him. And, you know, he gave me my first Dharma talk, the first time I really heard. And it's funny, growing up in a Buddhist household, I'm sure I heard this stuff before. but it's interesting, like, it's, you know, sometimes it's timing and sometimes it's the right teacher or the right place, right time. And I can remember I was probably only 11 or 12, maybe 10. And I can remember him saying to us, he said, you know, and I'm paraphrasing, and also I'm 41, so this was like 30 years ago. but I can remember him saying, you know, the majority of people, they either live in the future, you know, worrying about the future or hoping for something different in the future, you know, or they live in the past, you know, wishing things were the way they were or wishing or having regrets about the past. And like very few people live in the present. And even as like a really young child, I knew my mind was already like that. Not that I was a sad child. I was just, there already wasn't contentment in the present moment, you know, at 10 years old or something. So like, I remember that moved me. You know, I thought, oh my gosh, everyone else is like this too? I thought this was just me, you know. I just thought my life existed in the future. My happiness existed in the future. Things would come together in the future. So, you know, I don't think I ever experienced life the same after that. And it was such a deep teaching to learn at that time. And then, yeah, just being in his presence was like a teaching in itself. He felt like peace. He felt like peace. I never felt anything, you know, like it. So in a way, he's like, his example was like a proof to me that the teachings are, the path is real, you know, and it can be actualized. So, you know, felt like meeting, like the, you know, meeting a Buddha, really. Oh yeah, the only other anecdote was I think one time, I think we got a bunch of kids got invited to have tea with him or meet him in his hut, and I don't think it was planned, but he, you know, they practice hugging meditation at Plum Village, where you hug someone for 3 breaths in and out, and it's like it's a long, slow hug. And I think somebody gave something to him, and so he gave them a hug. And then all the children lined up, because everybody wanted a hug. And I don't think that was the plan, but of course, like, you know, he was there, and it's amazing that he lives on in so many people, and the impact is just incredible. So thank you.
So friends, why don't each of us just spend a moment just reflecting how in whatever way, if there's been a way, has Thay touched you? Again, teachings you've read, heard recordings of his talks, videos. What has touched you deeply? And then ask yourself, how can I be Thay's continuation? What gift have I received from him that I want to continue for my own benefit, for the benefit of my loved ones, those around me, and for the benefit of society, for the benefit of future generations? What is it in my life that I want to continue from him? Finally, let me just add one thing that I feel is very important that I left out this morning about my encounter with him. The teaching of just this, the teaching of only this, are ancient in Zen. But what he has added for us was not just dwelling in the present moment, but dwelling happily in the present moment. He was also unique in that he really taught us it's not simply a matter of being present to, it's how we are present to. And how we use the practice of present to cultivate happiness and joy. He said, that is our responsibility. He said, in this world where so many people don't know how to be happy with the simplicity of life, where there are so many things perhaps to be unhappy about, and he knew that firsthand, he said, it is our duty to learn to manifest happiness, to show the way that people can be happy in life, happy in their relationships. So I just wanted to share that with you, and that's a wonderful thing that we can continue here in our community and in our practice. So this brings to a conclusion our ceremony today, honoring our teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, again. We will have much opportunity in the future, by the way we nurture ourselves, by the way we nurture our community, by the way we grow together, to pay our deep debt of gratitude to him for having appeared in this world, for having taken a place on the world stage, for having manifested his wisdom and compassion in so many ways. We are all deeply indebted to him. And as he has often said, the best way we can repay him is by manifesting his teachings in our daily life and in our community. So may it be. So this will bring a formal conclusion. We'll have final bells, we will stand. Once again, bow deeply to our teacher, say the final gathas, and then we will end our ceremony for the day. I don't know, are there any announcements? I'm sorry, there's a final chant, forgive me. And this is a poem of Thich's that was set to music. Please come out of your seated posture. Prepare for standing. First, we bow to our teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh. Deepest gratitude, respect, love. And we all wish together for his speedy rebirth. Let he not go off anywhere else, but to come back and to continue to shine his great light in this world, to guide sentient beings out of their confusion, delusions, suffering, and show them the way to freedom and well-being. May you have a speedy rebirth, Thich Nhat Hanh. And then we bow to the community. Thich Nhat Hanh's continuation, out of deep respect and love. May we continue on this path together. And then we turn over the merit traditionally. Whatever benefit, whatever merit has come to us today, we offer to you, Thich Nhat Hanh, again for your speedy rebirth. And may all our efforts continuously ripple out into the world to bring healing and transformation to all we encounter. So thank you everyone for joining us today. Those of you who are live in the hall, those of you who are online, may you all be well. Thank you everyone.